Hello and welcome to the PK Soccer Youth Coaching Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Kelshaw. In today's episode, I am joined by Sam Hudson. Sam is a UEFA A licence and academy coach at Aston Villa Football Club. Sam is also a coaching consultant and tactical analyst with The Coach's Voice. In today's episode, we talk about Sam's coaching experience in the US and his progression from Category 3 to Category 1 Academy Coach. We also learn more about Sam's recent book publication, Football in a Pandemic, an insight into the strategies and tactics used during the 2020-21 Premier League season. Hi Sam, thank you for joining me this evening. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks Paul. Hope you're well.
I'm doing really well, thank you. And first, just give us a brief introduction. How did you first get into football coaching?
I guess kind of like a lot of young lads in the UK that are not going to have a playing career. I turned to coaching quite early on because I knew the playing journey, certain to the levels that you aspire to when you're younger, wasn't going to happen. So it was a case of deciding about college and universities and the sixth form routes. And I decided kind of sports coaching in general was probably the biggest passion I've got in terms of subjects. And I just followed the early coaching badges in the UK, the level one and the level two, working with grassroots, working with lots of different players. And pretty much ever since then, when I did my level one when I was 16, and I pretty much caught the bug straight away. And then it was a case of trying to plan a career without necessarily a playing background. And straight away, I always wanted to, university was always on the list. So trying to tie university degrees with certainly sports coaching and have as the backup idea of teaching lots of different sports, maybe the PE route as well, was kind of, the backup plan. But the main aim was always to try and work in football, to try and coach football to as high a level as I could get to. And I guess it kind of stems from my family's football mad anyway. We've got loads of different supporters, different clubs in the whole family. Some days it can be quite tense when certain teams are playing each other. But it's almost a little bit in your DNA. It's in your blood, really. You just get brought up with it. And I went to my first game when I was about 3 or 4. I had a season ticket. I went with my dad for kind of 10, 15 years throughout my youth. And it's kind of the only thing that I could see. As difficult as it can be at times trying to get a coaching career, particularly without that playing background, it's kind of always been the clear path, if you like.
And then, but it's good to hear as well for anyone listening that being a Premier League academy coach, that you started in grassroots and you started really at 16 as young as possible. So that's always a good story for anyone listening, that that's how you want to get involved in coaching. Obviously having that luxury of watching professional football as a child, mm-hmm. was probably similar to like what I did, is obviously a huge benefit. But then getting on the grass and helping out in any way you can is a good stepping stone for any coach. So how then, or what? Why did you choose the University of South Wales to continue your education?
Well, as I said, it was always a case of trying to get some kind of degree and theoretical base to your coaching, because I think there's a bit of a balance you have to strike. Ultimately, you have to be great on the grass. That will never change. But having some kind of theoretical and knowledge base behind it, I wanted to do. And at that point in my life, I wanted to kind of move to a new city and explore and live somewhere else for a little bit. So that was partly included as well. And I looked at the potential route to the States, the whole scholarship thing. But again, I felt at the time that the UK was probably the place for me at that time. And the University of South Wales came about purely because the way it worked at the time, I think it's still the same, or it might have changed fairly recently, but at the time, and this was back in 2011, it was basically a route where I could get 2 degrees from it, plus an opportunity to do the UEFA B licence. And whether you pass it or not is obviously up to you and your assessments. But the route was, it would be the first 2 years with a foundation degree, specifically in football coaching. I think it was titled Football Coaching and Performance. So every lecture, every theory, every practical, every meeting, every paper, everything that we did was linked always back to football. It was football specific. And then the key thing for me was after those 2 years, there was the option, again, if you passed certain modules and you were hitting certain marks, that you could do a top-up third year and also leave with a Bachelor of Science in Sports Coaching and Performance, I think it was titled. So then you get your more broader knowledge of different sports, you get different things in anatomy and physiology, sports psychology, you kind of cherry pick. Instead of just doing a psychology course or just doing an analytical course, it was modules from all those courses kind of thrown into 1 year. So it added that like well-rounded approach to being. And at the time, I probably took it for granted, to be honest, because I was always like, oh, I just want to be a coach. I just love coaching, love being on the grass. But as you get older, you learn the importance of the psychological side of things, the analysis, the strength and conditioning, the nutrition, all the different things that go into working with players, particularly young players that obviously grow and develop and change over a significant period. That the University of South Wales gave me that opportunity, as I say, to do a 2 year football specific degree and then the opportunity to get a Bachelor of Science on top of that. So after those 3 years, I managed to leave with 2 degrees, and then I was fortunate to pass my UEFA B license. So certainly in terms of on paper, and I spoke to a few students a month ago at one of the universities in the UK about, again, similar to what we're going to talk about, kind of create a career. A lot of it was straight away on paper. You need the qualifications that the job demands. If you apply for a job and you've not got the qualification, they're not going to give it you. It's a simple case of paperwork and the requirements. So I wanted to make sure that as early as possible, I could tick off as many qualifications as you can, and then you almost learn how to do the job through lots of experience working with different teams, different players, different age groups. And then another clincher for the University of South Wales was that they offered for a select few a placement with Cardiff City in their youth setup for about a year to 18 months, I think I was there for, and working with loads of different age groups, and again doing a bit of analysis, doing a bit of coaching, doing a bit of strength conditioning, doing lots of different things. And it gave you a little bit of a foot in the door in that system.
I was going to say that. Then you get you got that taste of whether it was football in the community or whether it was academy football. But the fact that you had that taste of professional or academy football. But also, I like what you mentioned as well about the psychology, that as a coach, or as really as a modern soccer coach, that you can't just be good on the grass. You've got to be well organized. And if you don't have that playing background, then you got to have some more feathers in your cap and be able to contribute in a different way. And plus as well, and I know from my own experience, as you get older, if you're obviously trying to make football coaching a full-time profession, there are only so many coaching hours that you can do. And if you can do something like on the analysis side, or even on, like for me, myself, like in a grassroots soccer club, just the day-to-day running of a club, that are huge benefits to the kids, like the behind the scenes that they don't see. But then obviously you're more involved in the behind the scenes of what's more beneficial to the players. So while you were at the University of South Wales, you're already prepared. You had like a career path in line, and you're able to gain the UEFA B license. Was that while you were at university, did you also go to America, or was that after you had graduated?
Yeah, so I went to the States, because the States was always on my bucket list, if you like, or kind of career pathway at some point, because I've been on vacation a number of times in my childhood. I've been to East and West Coast a couple of times and really enjoyed pretty much everything out there. So I always knew that at some point I will go out, and it was towards the end of my first year, and I was looking for something to do in the summers. I wanted to coach wherever I could, whatever I could, and however I could. Sent a lot of messages and emails, a few interviews, and a lot of things were bouncing back as either we're full or, you know, not quite fancy, or it just didn't seem to be landing, and it didn't look like I was going to get anything, certainly paid, and certainly to the States. And then an opportunity came up, and to be honest, I can't 100% remember how I actually got in touch with the guys in the first place. But basically, I went out with Disney in Florida, and they ran and I don't think it runs anymore. They ran something called the Disney Soccer Academy, and it was obviously through Disney, and it was marketed by Disney. It's Disney branding and everything to do with Disney, and it was based at the ESPN Sports Complex in Orlando, and a company from Michigan were kind of basically responsible for bringing in extra coaches and creating kind of the program to make it Disney. Gave their input to make it a Disney kind of thing where Mickey Mouse would turn up on the end of the week and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But then the company in Michigan would be based and responsible for the coaching side of things and working with the coaches and creating session plans. So I did that basically every year at the end of every university year. So after year one, I went for the first week was around 2 or 3 weeks in Florida. And then I went traveling around a different state every week doing the summer camps. And then I went back after my second year of college, but because I'd finished my UEFA B licence in the second year, I managed to get a bit more team coaching when I came back. So still doing the camps and stuff, but there's a little bit more kind of team and lots of shadowing, loads and loads of coaches around different states. And then the third year, I actually missed my graduation, the first one, because I was out in the States coaching at Disney. And again, one of the great things about that was the whole to keeping with the Disney branding and the Disney theme.
Yeah.
Every single day, there was an ex-pro like with the kids. So you'd spend the day with an ex-pro. And for a lot of them, it was kind of their first. So most of them were kind of still playing at some level. Most of them were kind of Premier League, a couple of them played Champions League. So they're really top pros. And they were almost starting their coaching journey. It was quite interesting to work with them that we're both on similar sort of, certainly coaching experience wise, but obviously some of them, as I said, played Premier League and played in lots of different tournaments and for top professional sides. So the first experience of the States was in basically every summer of college, and it was 8 weeks, and then the next two were kind of like 10, 12 weeks. So I was there for quite a while, and the amount of, I still say to this day to any young coach, the amount of sessions I must have done in those 8 to 12 weeks, like 2 or 3 a day comfortably, 5 days a week. And the amount of mistakes I would have made and ironed out all those no-nos, if you like, was, again, fantastic for me.
Well, that's why I like summer camps, because for a better word, you're somewhat of like a traveling circus that you go from town to meaning that you go from town to town each week. Obviously, we're all professional, but if you make a mistake or with a training session or something didn't quite work out, you just move on to the next camp. But I'd also, for any coach, typically if a camp is Monday to Friday for 3 hours a day, you're talking like 15 hours in 1 week. Like if you could coach in England, you coach a team for the season and you're only doing 1 hour a week, say with like a local grassroots team, then it's going to take you basically a whole season to get that much experience. So you can get so much experience, like you said, in a few weeks. And then as well, because it's new to everyone, you're coaching alongside Premier League or Champions League soccer players. Obviously, their playing might not necessarily translate into a coaching ability, but it's still it's something that you remember, and it's obviously an achievement, something that is that every coach would want to be able to have those kind of experiences. And also, I could imagine coaching for Disney, that there's also got to be you got to have a personality and be entertaining, and that's one thing that I think is essential, and especially the way that the world is. And maybe we'll come up to this when we talk about your book and the pandemic, but we seem to be like kids are getting the life sucked out of them because everything's regimented. Sit here, stay this distance apart, don't do this, can't use that equipment. And I do feel like, you know, if a coach with enthusiasm, with new ideas, and can promote problem solving and kids thinking for themselves, and it's experiences like this, like obviously two sides, coming to America for the experience, but then going to university as well, is is a huge thing. So when you've came back to England, you got involved with Burton Albion, is that correct?
Yeah, but there was a, so after the third, as I say, after I'd graduated university and then went back out to Disney, and instead of traveling around the circus again, I took a job permanently, moved over permanently in New York, New Jersey, and lived there for 18 months, 2 years, I think it was, working with, again, loads of different, taking like three or four teams, a couple of travel ones, a couple of the EDP, ODP kind of system, as it was, and working with some really, really good players, particularly in New York. There was some really, really talented players, and the New York City FC had just been founded, so they were, I think, were trying to set up their new system basically from scratch, and they started basically looking at pinching a load of players and then doing bits in New Jersey as well, where I was based. And so I was there for, I say, for a couple of years, just because I love the kind of the American way of life so much, and something that I'd, again, like really cherished from doing the Disney job, and then the traveling around, was the amount of people that I met, the amount of states that I went to in a couple of years, and the amount of locations in certain states that I went to. I would have never have gone without this job. I went to some real small towns in like upstate New York or in Vermont or South Carolina, or some really places I would never end up. And the people that you meet is, you don't realise it at the time, but it's certainly just as important as the jobs I was doing. And there's still quite a few people that I would still speak with. I spoke with a family last week that I stayed with, and I haven't spoken to for years, and I just managed to catch them on social media, and we had a good chat about, because I lived with them for like 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
Yeah. Well, one thing, it's been like a reoccurring theme with the podcast, that coaches have travelled to progress their career, and they've put themselves through education, and that's some of the things that you had done. And even if traveling to those places upstate may not necessarily have been the coaching memories, but maybe it was the coaches that you were with that you remember, or the families that you stayed with, or the kids that you met, or just the general, you know, experience in a different part of the world, just gives you an open mind. That's what really I'm trying to say, and can help you like improve.
And it kind of does help you as a coach, in the sense of probably not your technical and your tactical information, but your coaching delivery, and what you're talking about your mannerisms and your personality. That, like I said, when I first went, I was at 18. Well, just about to turn 19. I was still 18 when I got the first plane out to Disney. And you can imagine what parents, like, my mum was panicking that he's 18, he's just getting on a plane to America for 12 weeks, see you later. It makes you grow up a little bit, and not moving out there, I think I was 20 when I moved out there permanently, and you've got to, you know, fend for yourself now. You're in New York, or they're driving through Manhattan and Chinatown every day, driving, working in Brooklyn every day. It's, it builds lots of life qualities, which then make you a better coach, make you punctual on time, make you organised, make you, it increases your personality, because I don't think I would ever say I'm massively extrovert anyway. Certainly off the pitch as an individual, I'm relatively probably neutral or more leaning towards introvert. But as soon as I put cones out, as soon as I get on the grass, or as soon as I start talking about soccer or coaching it or watching it or whatever, then a little switch flicks in my head. And certainly those experiences during the university years, and then just before I came back to start my role with Burton, has certainly helped me in my career probably more than I'll ever realise.
So what was the reason then for wanting to come back to the UK?
Partly visas, partly a new challenge. It was a case, because I had obviously had a lot of short-term visas. It was more a case of, you've got to start thinking about the long-term. And with the experience that I had with Cardiff at university, it was a case of, I wanted to get back into the performance environment and that academy system. So it was a case of come back to the UK and see what I can find. And I was quite fortunate that, again, just trying to speak to as many people as you can, trying to shadow and watch sessions and stuff, and an opportunity came up pretty quickly when I came back to go in part time with Burton, and then alongside the academy stuff, I was working in schools doing the PE stuff. Which again, I go back to the start where that third year at university to get more varied coaching information and knowledge for other sports really helped with that role as well.
So then, like you said, it was just really kind of cold calling, just sending emails and phone calls, just trying to
make a lot
of contact to get a foot in the door.
Yeah, I think for the Burton one, to be honest, I think it was actually I wrote a letter, I think, to someone that I knew of at Burton and just said, oh, I'm back from the States. We've spoke briefly before. Can I come down and watch some sessions? And I went down a few for a couple of weeks. And they said, oh, we're going to be putting out a job next week. Apply for it and we'll give you an interview because, you know, you've come in for a couple of weeks and you've just watched and observed and shadowed us. And fortunately, I just nailed the interview. I can still remember the session. I can still remember the pitch and everything about it. It was a very good session for where I was at that time, and got offered the role as a academy coach there.
So would the first team be League One at the time?
They were, yes, because I was there when they got promoted from League One. So I was there for League One, and I was there. And I think I left when they were still in the championship before they went back down, I think.
And then what kind of age groups were you working with then at Burton?
So predominantly 9 to 13, really. That kind of, I started when I came, because I left the States at Christmas. So I joined the UK season midway through, and I was working with the 12s and the 13s. And then after that, it would have been the 10s, 11s, the 9s, 10s, 11s at Burton. So it's quite a mix of, it's in the States again. Something I've probably not mentioned is the amount of different age groups I've coached. And I made sure when I was in the States that there was bits doing 9s, 10s, 11s and bits doing the kind of middle 12 to 14s and then a couple 17s, 18s. And again, that's helped me massively with learning that you can do some sessions that are exactly the same from a 9-year-old to an 18-year-old. You can do same sessions, same topics. You just change terminology or you change your mannerism, but you can lay out the same cones. Or there's also sessions that wouldn't work and need to be adapted. So I think that helped me with at Burton, because I was quite flexible when I first started to say, oh, look, I'll just go wherever you put me. I'll be happy. I'll be coaching. You know, foot in the door, I'm in the system. I'll do what you want.
Well, I suppose that's what, you know, they're looking for, that, or really in any job that you get, that you are flexible and you're open to doing any kind of role really that's thrown at you. And then again, I know we're not really talked about it, but I can only imagine some of the things, if it's similar to what happened to me traveling with camps and travel teams within the US, that really, if you can deal with that, then anything anyone throws at you, that you can think on your feet and you can deal with. So from there, you progressed and you moved on to Derby County.
Yeah.
Was that, what was the reasoning behind that, and how did that opportunity come about?
So that was an official job that came up, and like kind of any other walk of life, you apply for it and you get interviewed and you go through that way. So, The main reasons kind of at the time was the Burton were Cat 3 and they were quite limited by budget, and Derby since been Category 1 and certainly from a youth perspective compete at the very highest level in the UK. And whilst I was there, we also showed that they can compete with teams in Europe, because a few years ago the under-18s won the Premier League North, and then they won the North East South kind of final game against Arsenal, and then they're in the 18s Champions League, whatever it's called, the Youth League, whatever, and got through reasonably well to there, knocked Dortmund out. So it was a case of a progression of club, a progression of standard, progression of quality. And Derby County have been my boyhood team as well when I was growing up. So that law added, it's something that kind of respectfully to most clubs, if not all clubs, that, you know, that's something that can match on that front. And the facilities are great. I knew a few staff there anyway, and they've always obviously spoke highly of the place and the environment. And everything at the time just seemed Right, and again, it was a case of probably one of the first jobs where it was an official, as I say, official job where I don't have to kind of speak to people off the cuff or write letters or ring people up. It was a job that came up formally on their official website. I sent in my stuff, did the interview, again, did the theory interview first, and then did the practical, and was fortunate enough to get given the job.
So what were some of the big differences then from a category three to a category one as far as facilities or as players' ability?
I think, yeah, facilities is obviously the first one, because I'd probably say 70 to 80% of Category 3 clubs don't own their own facility. However, you know, I was very fortunate that for a period of time when I was at Burton Albion, we trained at St George's Park. So in terms of facilities, like, you can't get
Okay.
too much better than that. However, there's always a feeling that I kind of get that, you knew. And there's no criticism on Burton and no criticism on St George's Park, but you always know this is not your home, your environment. This is not your facility, if you like. You're always going to be a guest, and I guess rightfully so. But the difference generically between Cat 1 and Cat 3, and then probably Cat 1 and Cat 2 as well, certainly facility is one. Budget is huge difference. And then the standard of play, I guess the whole way the EPPP is designed is that it's like that funnel where I think the phrase is kind of the best players, the best staff, the best facilities funnel upwards to category one. I guess that's the, and it is quite harsh. I do find on clubs, if you're buying from the category below you, that the set price that some young players can kind of be capped at doesn't help the lower clubs, because if a Cat 2, a Cat 3, particularly Cat 3, if they've had a real strong involvement in a player's journey and they've given them up a lot of time and effort, then they should be rewarded for that, certainly financially, because it will mean a lot more to them than it would to certainly some of the big Category 1s, particularly those teams that have been in the Premier League for a long time. And it's very common knowledge that Premier League clubs, compared to a League 1, League 2 club, the financial disparity is, in all environments, not just facilities, but staff and players and everything, is huge. I've always said that one of the positives from being in the Cat 3 environment is it makes you have to think outside the box and be flexible and come up with ideas to work with players that you can't just have the luxury of all the time of kind of not just throwing money at it, I wouldn't say, but you have to think differently at times. You have to be more adaptable, and you can't have everything your own way. And I'd say more often than not, that's a benefit for player development, and it's also a benefit for coach development as well.
So I suppose as well, being a Derby County fan, you got that added incentive to want to get the best out of players as well. But again, it must have been somewhat a bit of a disappointment, especially with the financial troubles that they're currently going through. And then
Yeah.
because of that, then having to leave, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. But as I knew, kind of, I would never say I would stay in one place forever anyway. I don't. I've never planned. Well, to be honest, I've never planned on, when I was, 15, 16, and speaking to my parents about, well, I was saying, what are you going to do with your life? And it was not the case that I don't know, but it was a case of, well, I want to work in sport, and as I said at the start, the part of the football. But the route, I don't know, and I'm not mega fussed about it. I never planned on living in New York and New Jersey. I
Yeah.
never planned on living in Florida. I never planned on working at Burton Derby Villa now. It was never kind of a black and white plan. You have to have an element of playing the hand you're dealt at times, and I've certainly had that more of late. But then at the same time, I do believe a little bit, it sounds a bit cheesy and corny, but things do happen for a reason. And ultimately, there's lots of great clubs in the UK, and there's lots of great opportunities abroad as well. Even if, I think I've been guilty of it in the past before, where you can sometimes get so preoccupied on, oh, what's the standard of play like? What's the club like? What's all the amenities like? But sometimes, if the environment's right for you at that time, then that's the right environment for you. And I think that's been quite true for me for a number of years.
So how did the opportunity at Aston Villa come about?
Very similar to the so again, it was an official job again that's come up. In some ways, I was kind of fortunate that from the time of leaving Derby to joining Villa, it was quite short. But because of kind of how the situation went, it meant I could join quite quickly, which is always a benefit from kind of a potential employer. You could, I say, I could start tomorrow if you want me to.
Yeah.
With, you know, just ticking a couple of boxes. But and I was quite fortunate to know a couple of staff there anyway that can always put good words in for you. And I've worked with people there at other clubs. I worked with one or two at Derby, especially, that are now at Villa. And as with any environment in any organisation, that they will speak, if I've worked with somebody there before, they're straight away going to go to them and what's he like? What's his personality? Does he fit our brand? Does he fit the way we're going to coach? Does he fit our philosophy and all that sort of stuff? And at Villa, there's kind of been, way before I've been there, there's been a few changes in terms of the style and the philosophy and the way things want to go. And again, I'm very fortunate to say I fit that style and style of play and the way you want to coach plays and the systems and everything that Villa look for. I still feel and fortunately they feel that we're a good fit and a good match.
So what age groups do you currently work with? So
I predominantly work with the under-14s. So they're my kind of main focus, but I'll also chip in with other age groups on different bits.
And they're travelling within the Midlands, or is it?
No, it's as COVID kind of hopefully disappears in terms of not becoming as, I don't think it would disappear obviously, but in terms of not being as much of an issue, it should start to open up again. So the academy system tends to be relatively regionalised anyway. The first kind of main split is like a north v south really, and then within that you'll have a couple of sections that you play the majority of your fixtures. So we'll play the majority of our fixtures in the Midlands in what's called the Games Programme. But the Premier League do leave lots of gaps in the season for you to arrange your own fixtures, which is great to then play different teams around the country in different styles and different categories, which I think is really important. And the Premier League also run lots of different tournaments, depending on what age and stage they're at. The tournaments look different. So for the younger ones, they do lots of kind of small side of stuff, the five-a-side tournaments, they do futsal tournaments, they'll do the in and out of balance, which is, I think, my favourite one, where it's you play every team twice and the first game is you've got seven, they've got five. Then they flip it, you've got five, they've got seven. And then the only real condition is if your score is the five, your goals are doubled against the seven as the underloaded team. And you get some really interesting games. You get some really interesting tactics from coaches, from clubs. You get some really interesting ideas from players. And I think the Premier League do balance it quite well. Of some tournaments are qualifiers as well. So if you don't, so if you finish top of your regional group, you then go to a national final, which I've been quite fortunate to work with some really talented players that have pretty much dragged me to a final rather than the other way around. And that balance of we're developing individuals, it shouldn't be results based, but you should never ignore the result because the result will always tell you something. And there should be moments in their journey where the result means more than the development. For, you know, it's like that equaliser that you have to slide in different moments. And there will be moments, and like I say, the Premier League, I think for me, I've got the balance quite well where, you know, we'll be in some competitions and it will be geared around, right, can we win the game without compromising our style and all the stuff we train, but we are going to notice the result a little bit more tonight. And then the Games Programme fixtures is more about the individual challenges that we set players, what we've been working on across weeks. So there's quite a mixed balance of not just opponents, but the environment that you create for them as well.
Is there a big part of it? Is it the having to scout and watch film of opposition?
Not so much for the schoolboy programme, so for the 1916. It is more on the post-match stuff. So it's more about the stuff we can control.
Okay.
For the really young ones, the foundation phase, which in academies is under 9 to under 12 at most clubs. Sometimes it's under 9 to under 11, but it's mainly 9 to 12. It's like the analysis is drip-fed in. It might be a couple of compilations of players doing dribbles or tackles or goals, or there might be little bits. And we always encourage, every club I've worked at, I've always encouraged players to create their own clips so they get access to the games, which is great for some parents who, again, quite rightly, they probably don't want to travel all the way down to London to watch games or whatever, so they can sit and watch it on the at their leisure at home on the software that a lot of clubs use. So a lot of games are filmed, and it will be more, again, individual clips and then some team clips. And as they get older, it'll be more post-match analysis, say at the start of a week, for example, and you can focus on things in training that have gone really well or things to focus on, and you can try and tie. Again, this is where the facilities comes in, where if you've got a big screen kind of in an indoor pitch, for example, and you can, you're literally on the pitch, but then you can see the footage and vice versa. And a lot of clubs, certainly at Cat 1 level, have the iPads and laptops, and you can sit with players in, during the training and show them clips of the footage. Or I've always tend to use clips of top level players, because if I use an example of working with a central midfielder and say you look at someone like Iniesta, who is changing direction and his ability to hide and shield the ball, I've always felt with players that if I give them that information myself, sometimes they might go, well, yeah, okay. But then if I show a clip of Iniesta doing it, they're probably going to pay a lot more attention, because the proof's in the pudding there. He's doing it and he's won World Cups and Champions Leagues. So I think tying that video footage element with your coaching, if you can do it, it is great. And again, finding the balance of not overkill and certainly not starting it too young, and developing that love for the game. But I think it can be a really powerful tool, particularly if you highlight something that a player's doing really well and then show them a clip of, I know quite a long time ago, a player I worked with who I felt was athletically was unbelievable with sprint speed, and he's very good at running in behind. And I thought, well, let's clip him running in behind and try and make sure he keeps on side more than he is. And we show lots of runs of people like Mbappe running in behind, and Bale and Ronaldo, and tying clips of him doing it well and then side by side with an Mbappe, and the buzz that the players get from seeing them do something well and seeing the requirements of certainly the environments I've been in, where you're trying to create professional players if you can. I found that to be quite powerful. But then the pre-match stuff would be, as I say, predominantly 16s and ups, and certainly 18s and 23s.
So what is a typical week for an academy coach?
Most will train 3 times a week. Some train more, some train less, but I'd say the average certainly is 3 sessions a week. There'll be strength and conditioning sessions tied in as well, where the older lads will be doing gym work, they'll be doing plyometric work, kind of specific muscle stuff and specific physical movements. Ideally, I've always said they should be linked to the topic you're working on, so everything is quite linear and quite tied together. So if you're working on a out of possession top, if you're defending in a block, it should be lots of lateral side-by-side movements when you're screening and moving across with the ball, lots of acceleration, decelerations if you're pressing and slowing down. So that physical side should be tied into that. A lot of clubs do the day release program, where they'll come in at least one or maybe a couple of days a week to get a bit more extra training, but then they'll also do school work as well, certainly as they hit secondary school age in the UK. As soon as they hit the mid-teenage years, a lot of Cat 1, Cat 2 clubs will, certainly Cat 1s will have a day release program where they get education with the club. And then some, as I say, some teams train most days, some will train 3 days, 3 evenings. Most clubs I've been at will train 2 evenings and then a Saturday, and then Sunday tends to be the game day for most things, but there might be games on a Saturday as a change, but predominantly Sunday is your game day.
So as part of your role as an academy coach at Aston Villa, you also work for the Coach's Voice.
Yeah.
What is your position there, and what's your role with the Coach's Voice?
So I basically contribute and work on the majority of their tactical and technical content for coaches, whether it's managers work, whether it's players, or a lot of the pieces that go on the site I've done for the last 3 or 4 years. I've also done a lot of stuff with the coach education stuff, and there's two kind of branches of site. There's the subscription part of the website for certainly for more coach education content, and then there's also the I say the free website is just a website where there's a lot more wider generic footballing content. And I've bounced across the two for, it'll be, yeah, 4 years in kind of February, March next year. So 3.5, nearly 4 years. I've been fortunate to be with them and contribute to a lot of the good content that they've got. And yeah, it's been a good ride with them.
So one of the main reasons that we connected was about your new book, Football in a Pandemic.
Yeah.
If you was your work at the Coach's Voice in Aston Villa, is that what, or really just in generally in academy football, is that what inspired you to write the book?
Yeah, I guess a little bit. I mean, a considerable part of my week is watching lots of clips and creating content around that. To be honest, the main kind of rationale for the book was so with the COVID in the UK and being on furlough from coaching, because as one of the professions that you work with lots of people, particularly work with young people, and as soon as the school started shutting, as a coach, you're not going to be able to go to work. So not being able to work and not being able to do much really did my head in quite a lot. And I've always done my own kind of, let's say, private analysis or little bits where I'd watch certain games, and if I saw something, I'd like, oh, I'll write that down, and I'll go and watch it another time. Or I've got a phrase that the best coaches are the best thieves, and I try and nick as many ideas as possible. And as I've, I guess, gradually through my career, kind of working with better players, but also working more now, more than ever, really, with the 11v11 and more the tactical side of the game, I've always felt that that's probably an area that can will never be settled, because there's always new things, there's always new trends that you have to manage and keep. But then there's also old things of the past that you can still use. And that general study of the game, I always felt, was a really important part of being a coach. So yeah, it was a case of some of my private collection that I was doing, again, in keeping with a lot of my career, it was just a very casual chat initially with the publisher, and they liked the idea of looking at kind of tactical content, but also merging it into bits on the pandemic. So the first chapter of the book looks at, essentially, it's no tactics at all. It's more so how the home and away bias completely flipped because there's no fans, how that affected, refereeing decisions, kind of the potential bias that a home crowd would always give on a referee, the influence of VAR, and the fact that with no fans in the ground, for example, that a decision could take ages and there'd be nobody moaning because there's nobody there. The fact that, again, the schedule of the season was, because of the break, they crammed so many games in, didn't they, in the Premier League within such a short space of time, and then they had to finish the season and then start up the next one, and you've got the Euros at the end of it, so you've got to finish it early, and there's games all the time, and not just that increase of risk for injury, but then you're thrown in COVID as a reason to miss games, and players in seasons before would never miss a game through COVID because it wasn't a threat to everyone. So that affected squads, and obviously the increased number of substitutes that teams could have, and all those little factors that were apparent across that season. And then the book looks at specific kind of tactical breakdowns. So all 20 teams are covered in the book, but there's a few that have a significant kind of chapter and as a feature. And that kind of fell about, the way I organised that was purely through, I guess, a lot of it was through my own interest. And I didn't just want to look at the top four teams, for example. So I've looked at lots of different teams across throughout the league, and I've kind of split it as a coach in mind. So I've split the first part is in possession. So the first chapter after the COVID part looks at playing out from the back and building the attack. And that's mainly through Leeds United. Then the creating chances part of that after the build, the kind of going from mid to attacking third is Brighton. I was really fascinated by how they played, certainly last year, and continue to play and create chances considering size of the club and budget and all that. Then the finishing attack and the goals was more of a league study, and I thought that was an opportunity to get all 20 teams in and how they scored goals and how they tried to attack. Then two transitions, so the counter-attacking, the attacking transition was mainly West Ham United, and how it was. I found it a bit of a challenge to look at specific moments, but not ignore the moment previously. So how West Ham counter-attack is a lot of a consequence of how they defended, and vice versa. And then the defensive transition was Liverpool, because for me, they're still the best at the moments when the team loses the ball. For me, Liverpool are still the best at that. And then the high pressing, the out of possession stuff. So the really aggressive pressing up the pitch was Manchester City. The mid block, ironically enough, I wasn't working there at the time, but it was Aston Villa. And then the low block stuff was a little bit on Tottenham and then a little bit on Everton, because there was a couple of ideas that Mourinho tried previously with Man United that didn't quite strike the balance of defending deep but then being a threat on the counter-attack, like we saw Tottenham did against Liverpool the other night, and his twists at Tottenham, and then how Everton used a similar idea, but the pros and cons of like the low block stuff. So for every kind of moment of the game tactically, there is detail of it. And there's as many different examples as I could try and give in those moments. So for me, hopefully it's quite a well-rounded kind of tactical ideas and strategies with, say, the COVID. And because I thought it was, touch wood, hopefully we don't have a season like it again where fans aren't going and it's, you know, it's absolute carnage. So I thought of all the seasons to do a bit of a detailed analysis on, but that's probably the best one.
I suppose maybe it helps as well because they started televising the 10 a.m. No, sorry, not the 10 a.m. It's 10 a.m. in the US. I mean, the 3 p.m. matches. Did that? And maybe you had access to a lot of the footage as well. But I think the fact that basically you could watch all the matches, really, if because they were made more available. And I know when you, I'm a Burnley fan, and well, Burnley were the first team to get a result at Anfield with no real home advantage. And then obviously I know Liverpool had a lot of injuries and such forth, but even so they somewhat lost that advantage.
Absolutely.
So is this book geared towards, giving a fan more knowledge, or is it geared towards coaches?
Hopefully it can kind of hit lots of different areas. I said predominantly it's coaches, people that work in the game at some capacity, coaches, analysts, scouts, whatever. I'd say there's at the start I try and explain, there's some terminology in the book that I use that explains certain things that certainly fans might not have ever heard before. Or throughout the book, I'm always trying to be quite consistent, even when I'm coaching, that to describe an area on the pitch can be quite complicated with the game so fluid that I'll just split it into five lanes, like a lot of coaches do. And some coaches call the two, if it's 1 to 5, 2 and 4, they call them the half spaces. That's a term that's never really settled with me. I don't understand. And I know it's a translation from the German kind of equivalent, but so for me, that's like the inside channels. So the wide area, the two widest ones, you've got the central lane and then the inside channel. So some fans might be saying inside channels, what the hell are that? But hopefully, again, right at the start, there's a kind of like a terminology and a pitch layout and some ideas. So there'll be some things that fans will be hopefully interested in, particularly as I say, it covers every team anyway, and it covers teams that you might not think. So the reason why I did Leeds United for the playing out from the back was because, so again, being a Derby County fan, I watched a lot of Leeds in the Championship for...
through your binoculars.
through 10, 15 years, and seeing how, with respect to the people before Bielsa, how he took that team and he didn't spend loads of money and bring in loads of players, but he turned them from, well, again, respectfully, a pretty average team to those two seasons in the Championship, some of the best football I've ever seen in my life. And I've been to the Nou Camp and watched Barcelona. I've been to the Euros and watched Italy, Spain, all these top teams. I've been to the Champions League and watched Man City, watched all these top teams. And just the style of football was really... I remember the first time I saw them, and within 3 or 4 minutes, I had to get my notepad out and started jotting things down, because it was just stuff you're thinking, this is incredible. And I was really interested to see how that translated into the Premier League. And, you know, I mentioned it in the book how a lot of teams that go up from the Championship, often quite rightly so, when they go to, I don't know, Anfield, they go to the Etihad, they go to Old Trafford, they shut up shop and they play quite deep. And you saw with Tottenham the other day against Liverpool, Tottenham are a massive club and that they hit them on the counter attack because you know the threats that top teams can have. But Leeds were like, no, we're going to play out, we're going to deal with their press, and we're going to stick with what we've got. And they did it with great quality as well. So hopefully that element of, like I say, it's not just Man City, Chelsea, Man United, and Arsenal, Liverpool. It's not all the top teams. There's, you know, Brighton deserve a mention, Villa deserve a mention, West Ham deserve a mention, and hopefully then that can appeal to a broader audience.
So anyone that was listening in the US who was, you know, a fan of the Premier League, I still talk to, you know, volunteer coaches that might be middle-aged men that may not have a team that they follow, or they pick a team later in life because, you know, football was not, it's new to them because of their child's playing. So sure. A book like this could give someone an insight into all 20 clubs from last season, and really an insight into all the different playing styles as well. But then I guess it also for full-time coaches as well, like you and myself, obviously working with different levels of the game, but it would give someone like myself who's working with grassroots players in a community club, working with local players, could give me like insight into the different styles of play and ideas that could potentially be implemented with youth players as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some elements that are kind of like the team tactics and what. So I'll take the Man City pressing chapter, for example, is how they pressed against difference, how they pressed against a back four or a back three. So teams, so coaches that I guess are working with 11v11, there's hundreds of different ideas on how to press or how to play out, or depending on how the other team is set up. And what I try not to do is speak about individual players and more about the generic, so it could be lifted a little bit easier. Because if I started speaking about specific players, then a lot of coaches rightly would turn around and go, well, I haven't got that player to do that. Whereas a lot of the more kind of generic ways of pressing, for example, and some of the triggers or... So in the Brighton chapter, I spent a little bit talking about on the details of like disguising a pass, and if you're trying to play through two players, for example, or different positioning or movement. So you can work with kind of 10-year-olds on cutting the ball back across your body. So hopefully that coaches of all levels can take little bits from, as you say, different styles, different ideas, but then tie it in with individual actions, but then the bigger picture as well.
So are there diagrams?
So every kind of page or two, there'll be like the pitch layout. And as I said, the pitch is always split into five lanes to try and keep that clarity of information. So in the text, if I'm talking about the inside channel, the wide area, then, you know, they know that is that specific lane. There's diagrams. I can't remember how many. I think there's nearly 100 diagrams, and there's 220 odd pages. So there's nearly a diagram every couple of pages. And the players that I'm speaking about in the book will also have the number in bracket. So when you look at the diagram, that number is, and again, that can be quite contentious because some, so I've learned this at Villa as well, the central defensive midfielder at Villa, we call it a six. I'd call it a four. But again, it's differences of, and again, I explain that in the book, that whatever number I'm talking about, it means this, because it can easily lead to confusion. I found in the book when I was talking about four, six, or twos and threes, it's just quicker and it flows better. But ultimately, if the reader doesn't know what I mean by that two, then it's irrelevant, isn't it?
Well, I think any coach that studied UEFA or United States Soccer Federation coaching course, they're using the numbers system, even though different cultures will, the numbering system, especially with the four and six, does vary. Where is the book available? If somebody wanted to purchase the book, how could they get their hands on a copy?
Yeah, so like with most things nowadays, you'd have to go speak to Mr. Bezos, and it's available at Amazon. There's the hard copy version, the actual, you know, physical copy of the book, and then there's also the Kindle but online PDF version. So there's electronic and hard copy. Amazon's, like I said, is the best route, but there's loads of different places in the UK. You've got Waterstones and WH Smith's and all those kind of retailers. But then in the States, again, if you just googled football in a pandemic, I think there's like Barnes and Noble have got it in stock, and there's one called The Hive, I think, as well. And as I say, Google football in a pandemic, and my advice is buy the cheapest one.
So have you seen the book on the shelf, like in Waterstones or?
No, because they've only, so we've just, so part of the reason, again, why I did the book was I wanted it kind of released in and around the summer, whilst, particularly whilst the Euros is on, and it would be, you know, quite in keeping with the whole pandemic and football theme at the time. But due to, and I mean, I sound like I'm really enough excuses here, but everything under the sun from, so COVID obviously disrupted things, the Suez Canal blockage disrupted trying to get the books printed and transported around the world, shipping container issues, Brexit, lorry driver shortages, anything you can think of kind of kept pushing it back, and it eventually got released kind of October, November. So stock in terms of in shops has been very, very slow to get out there. And admittedly, if I knew it was going to be released in November, October, November, what I would have done is spent the summer looking at, I wanted to look at a bit more in the how the COVID impacted it, with more data getting released over the summer and more points and issues, and how it might have affected the Euros, and looking at players from the Premier League that played in the Euros and how did they perform. Because my final bit on the book was the last time I touched it was in May, expecting it to be the June, July release. Which is a shame, but it's the way of the world, and every decision, every kind of issue is out of my control. I can't control lorry driver shortages or anything like that. So yeah, not seen it yet, but I've been told, I got an email last week saying it's on the shelves for just in time for Christmas. And
That's
hopefully.
what I was going to say, that now's the time where, and especially we're just recording this just before Christmas, that people are going to have Amazon gift cards coming out their
Yeah.
ears. So that's the I'm sure it's going to be a, January will be a good time for the
Yeah,
for people to
absolutely.
purchase the book. Sam, really appreciate your time and your insight in learning a little bit more about you as a coach and your new book, Football in the Pandemic. And I wish you all the best with the book and all the best for 2022.
Thanks a lot, Paul. I appreciate your time, mate.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the PK Soccer Podcast. Don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter at Paul Kelshaw, Instagram at Paul Kelshaw, like my Facebook page at PK Soccer Inc., or send an email, paulkelshaw@pksoccer.org. I would also be grateful if you could give the podcast a review and a rating and share with your fellow coaches and friends. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.